You're listening to KTOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The seven personal stories you are about to hear were told on January 14th at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Rearview Mirror. Music was performed by Cousin Curtis. Iris Addie Benson Nash moved to Alaska for good just 2 years ago. She is a commercial fisherwoman working with her husband in their power, and she wrote this. So for those of you who take issue with fisherwoman, she wrote this. Okay. Fisherwoman working with her husband in their power trolling operation, which doubles as their home year round. You may have met Iris while working alongside Kodiak Coke Company when she started her own Skookum Apparel Company, as well as in other odd jobs about town. Please welcome our first speaker of the night to the stage, Iris.
Well, where are you from? It's generally been one of the hardest questions for me to answer. Generally, I say Petersburg, because I was born in Petersburg when my parents owned an oyster farm outside of Cake. But I wasn't raised in Petersburg. I was raised somewhere along the way from Petersburg to Renton, Washington, to Olympia, Washington, Montesano, Boisfort, Centralia, Rochester, Myrtle Creek, Oregon, Roseburg, Oregon, Juneau, Alaska, Roseburg, Oregon, back to, and then Petersburg again, back to Roseburg. And then I moved to Anchorage, Alaska, where I finally graduated high school. Finally. That was seven high schools and many, many homes later. And it was a really long road, and it really sucked to move schools that many times. But my parents never intended to move so much. They were only ever doing what was best for me and the best that they could do before and after the divorce. But, you know, I turned 12 and got ornery and started fighting with my mom, and she kicked me out. And that was me learning that I could manipulate my situation and continue leaving, because leaving was easy for me. And that was what I knew to do. And I was the best leaver I'd ever known. Yeah, I just bounced around a lot, and I moved to Southern Oregon with my dad and his new family, and I moved back, and my mom wanted to start over. We moved to Juneau, Alaska for a new start, just her and I. And that lasted 2 weeks. Then I went back to Myrtle Creek, and then, dad broke up with his girlfriend. He moved into a one-room place. I'm like, I'm not living with you in a one-room place. I'm 15 years old. I move in with a girlfriend. We, do our own thing. We had the freest time of my life. I had the least amount of responsibilities, but the freedom of an adult. And, then my mom caught wind that I was living with my friend. And then she said, come visit me in Petersburg. Now I live in Petersburg. Come hang out. And then she didn't buy me a ticket back. I was pissed. I was 15 and stuck in Petersburg, and I had nothing in common with anyone except maybe we smoked Marlboro Reds. And I fought my way out. I made my mother's life a living hell until she agreed to let me leave. Yeah, I moved back down to Roseburg, Myrtle Creek. I'm still living with my friend. Then eventually moved to Roseburg, town over. My friend moves in with me and my dad and our new family. And eventually, my dad's girlfriend goes to jail for manslaughter. And so, they break up. So then we move into this one-room apartment above a comic book store downtown Roseburg, and we don't have running water. I'm 16, and I'm pissed off, and I stop coming home. I drop out of school. I would rather live with my friends who pseudo have their lives figured out, because they live off welfare, and we think we have it figured out. Yeah, that lasted a little while, and then my dad said, okay, she won't come home, she won't do anything, I have no control over her. You have custody. Come get her. So my mom comes to get me, and I tell her, no, I'm not leaving. I've figured it out. I've been living on my own. I know how to do this. And, and she said, well, you know, I got custody. So it was either, you know, run from the police for 2 more years or just, you know, bite the bullet and do it. And I did, finally. I said, okay. So we moved to Anchorage. I'm all along thinking, oh, I'll find a way out. I always do. But she stood her ground. And the only thing she could do with me when I didn't do anything she said was send me to the authorities. So, you know, I was locked up and, you know, I learned my lesson. And somehow my mom and I came to an agreement. And I learned that I was only ever running from myself. And that as much lead as that was, I only had to deal with myself to really get over the hardships I felt in my life. As much as I wanted to blame it on my parents and everyone else in the world. And eventually I graduated high school, and it was a monumental moment. And I left Anchorage, and I packed up my 1983 300 SD turbo diesel Mercedes with mostly clothes and fabric and sewing machines. And I spent a few months on the road, and I landed in Portland. And I'd wanted to move to Portland ever since I wanted to get emancipated when I was 11 years old. Being determined I would always be independent, always be on my own, and do whatever the hell I wanted, always. And today, I still do. Just for entirely different reasons. And while living in Portland, my life was just rocked, and I was not ready for it. And today, I am a woman who moved back to Alaska, and I'm pretty much the exact person my parents wanted me to be. And at first, I hated that. But it's really, I am exactly who I want to be, and it is bizarre. And I am a 21-year-old married woman, pregnant, and a commercial fisherwoman living on a boat in Alaska, and I'm stoked about it. And I've found my new way of home and meeting my husband and believing in true love that I never thought could possibly exist has changed my world. So thank you.
Our next speaker is KJ Metcalf. KJ and his wife Peggy have lived in Southeast Alaska for 53 years, where they have raised 3 kids who thrived growing up in the outdoors. KJ and Peggy lived in Angoon for 18 years, where they owned Angoon Trading Company, ran youth camps, and occasionally commercially guided wilderness trips. They claim to never have lost a kid or a client, occasionally misplaced them, but never really lost them. When Admiralty Island was made a national monument, KJ was appointed the first monument ranger. He considers himself a professional when it comes to traveling and living in the bush. Tonight you can hear his side, but check with Peggy for a second, more nuanced opinion. Here's KJ.
Good. So I'm up here to embarrass myself tonight. I've been thinking about this all week. Rearview mirrors, and I thought, metaphorically, really, actually. So I'm going to tell some stories about around our cabin in Atlin. If you've not been to Atlin, it's about 40 miles that way across the ice field, an incredible lake, beautiful country. We have this cabin up on a ridge, overlooks the lake, just beautiful. When we first built the cabin about 20-some years ago, we didn't have an outhouse, but we had an outbox. And what that is just a hole in the ground with a box built around it with a toilet seat. And you sit there and you look at this incredible view. So I'm sitting there, and you got to imagine this, pants down to my ankles, looking out, and a boreal or a chickadee comes and lands next to me. And it's got some moss in its beak and a little bit of grass, and it looks at me and it hops on my head and starts pulling my hair out. And I wanted a picture. Selfies hadn't been invented yet. I yelled for Peggy. She was somewhere else. So I had my daughter, who's an artist, memorize this in a picture which is back on the piano. So you need to check that out. Next incident had to do with one day we came back to the cabin. We were down on the lake. You have to hike about a quarter of a mile up to the cabin, and it's at an end of a dirt track to park your truck. And so we hiked up to the cabin, and here's our ice chest strewn out across the side of the bank. And I said, oh, got a bear. And I was angry at myself because didn't want to make a garbage bear, but this was the only place where we could have put the ice chest. So cleaned everything up, burned the garbage, put the ice chest inside, went to bed that night, and of course the bear came back. And Peggy nudged me and said, the bear is back. Your bear is back. It's my bear. So I jumped up in my underwear, grabbed a can of bear spray. I'm going to go out and confront this bear. I want it to have a bad experience, go away, not ever come back. So I go out, and it's a medium-sized adult black bear standing at the corner of the cabin watching me. So I get the bear spray ready, and I advance on the bear. I'm about the right distance away. This is going to work. It's going to be gone. And I pull the trigger, and this orange cloud goes out. And it's like a cartoon. It just kind of hovers there, and then it just comes right back. And a puff of wind had come around the cabin. I can't see. I'm screaming. There's a bucket of water nearby, so I get the stuff out of my eyes. My tears are streaming down. And the bear is looking at me. So I say, this time I'm going to get it. So I go up and I fire a second shot at it, but it's empty. And growing up, I watched a lot of cowboy movies, and I know what happens when the gun's empty. You throw it. So the bear is over by the tree now, kind of backed up, and it's going to go up this tree, and that's the last thing I wanted it to do. So I threw the can, and it just slow motion is just turning and turning, and it hit the bear square on the head. He looked up, dropped down, and galloped away, and I never saw him again. Again, in my underwear with my empty bear can, the spray, walked into the cabin, and Peggy said, so how did that work? I said, that bear spray is great. It worked just perfect. Bear's gone. She said, yeah, I was looking out the window and I watched. She said, you are a real professional. I would follow you anywhere. There was just a hint of sarcasm in that. The last event was early one morning. Ground was frozen a couple of years ago. A little bit of snow. Beautiful, quiet morning. Late fall. I was building another trail up to the cabin, so I went down a couple of switchbacks and stepped off into the brush, and I'm standing there thinking, okay, I can bring the trail up, cut that tree, don't have to cut many branches off, just kind of moving a little bit, much like an animal would if it were just standing there feeding. And then I heard a branch break. And going back to my cowboy movies, when it's quiet and you hear a branch break, bad things are going to happen. Thundering footfalls. And I said, what is it? And I started looking, trying to figure out. I was sure it was a moose and it was running away, but it was coming towards me. And that wasn't good. And I turned around, and this black wolf had been watching me and decided I was on the menu, and he made this big circle around behind me, and he was coming straight for me from behind, and he was about ready to launch when he ran into my scent and realized I was on the menu but wrong species. And he literally turned around in midair just as I turned around and hit the ground and went off running. And, by the time I figured it out, it was all over. And I thought, that's pretty cool. I was prey. So I just leave you with this, that it's very humbling to be prey, and sometimes you might actually be more one with the wilderness than you really want to be.
Our next speaker is Julie North Sinclair. She moved to Juneau in 1986 from New York City and found that dancing to Danny and the C-Notes in downtown Juneau was just as fun as bopping to the Beastie Boys at CBGB's. After moving 6 times in 12 years with her Coast Guard spouse, she is hoping to stay in Juneau for good. Her chances of doing that will increase if you offer her a job in her field of medical coding and reimbursement. Medical coding and reimbursement. Note. She is currently living on the Douglas side of the bridge. She refuses to say West Juneau, and has a 15-year-old son, Finn, who once graced this stage with his violin music and was baptized right in this spot where I'm standing, where she'll be standing. Please welcome Julie.
My father is famous, world famous, to a very narrow segment of the population. If you have raced sailboats in Detroit, in Chicago, in Tokyo, in Finland, Auckland, Sydney, Australia, you've heard of my father. And you probably, at one point in your life, sailed in a boat with his distinctive company logo on your sail. My father's a legendary yachtsman. He's a gold medalist in the Olympics, 5-time world champion in his class. He was 16 years old when he won the first world championship in 1945. They nicknamed him the Pope. Paul Elvstrom, the Danish sailor, got to be God. He had 4 gold medals. My brother and my sister, they're older than I, they grew up, they loved to sail. From the time they were 8 or 9, they were racing against each other in sailboats, competed against each other on their college sailing teams, and as adults, they explored the world with long ocean voyages on sailboats with their respective partners. I hate to sail, and I hate to be on boats. My friends talk about the joy and the freedom of sailing. I would say terror and claustrophobia. Yeah, claustrophobia. When I'm on a boat, I can only move a few feet in this direction, a few feet in this direction, maybe 10 or 15 feet in that direction, depending on the size of the boat, and that's it. I'm stuck. I don't like to be stuck. I have other reasons, really good reasons, for being afraid of boating, but you'll just have to trust me on that. So I never learned to sail, but I had a last name that was synonymous with sailing, at least in our community, which led to some really amusing moments by the time I was a young teenager. For example, when I was 13, a young, attractive teenager invited me out on his small sailboat for a nice sail. We're sailing along, a breeze lifts his hat off of his head and it falls into the water. He immediately dove in after it, assuming that I would maneuver the sailboat brilliantly by myself because I was the daughter of Lowell North. Now, we have to fast forward 25 years now. And by that time, I was living in Ketchikan, and I was married to the captain of a Coast Guard ship there. You didn't see that one coming, did you? And we had a 1-year-old son. My father, by that time, was retired from his sailmaking business, and he and his wife decided to come up and visit us in Ketchikan. They came all the way up from San Diego, California. I'm not sure they knew Canada was involved in there, and visited us in Ketchikan. And by the time they arrived, what did they want to do with us? They wanted to have a nice day out sightseeing on their boat. Now, who was I to refuse? How many thousands of miles had they come to visit us? But I did insist that my highly trained Coast Guard spouse be on board with us. My father, while noted for his speed and ingenuity on the ocean, was not so well known for his caution or restraint. So the day arrived, and it was a beautiful sunny day, calm seas, and we all went out on the water to enjoy each other's company, to enjoy the wildlife and the beautiful scenery around Revilla Island. And my one-year-old was with us, too. Around the middle of the day, the boat stopped and the engine stopped, and I soon learned that this was not planned. This was not our lunch stop. As many of you know, the waters around Ketchikan are very deep, so there was not much talk of trying to anchor. And my father disappeared into the engine room to see what he could do to get the engine going, to get the motor running again. We were drifting towards some rocks. Time was going by. And in case I wasn't having enough fun already, I managed to fall down the ladder or the stairs or whatever you call them on a boat from the top deck to the main deck with my baby in my arms. My son was fine. I, however, was beginning to wonder whether perhaps this was my own custom-designed personal nightmare. So we called the Coast Guard, much to the embarrassment of my husband. And when they arrived, they assessed the situation and said that we were out of gas. My brilliant father, who has a dock named after him at MIT, had forgotten to fuel up the boat before our journey that day. So the Coast Guard had some gas, they gave it to us, engine fired right up, and we were on our way. About an hour later, it was getting dark, but I wasn't worried because I could see the lights of downtown Ketchikan where the marina was, and so I wasn't worried that it was getting dark. Until the boat stopped again, that hadn't given us quite enough gas. So we called the Coast Guard again, a little more sheepishly this time. Hi, remember us? And they very kindly came out and towed us to Coast Guard Base Ketchikan, which, of course, my husband was really familiar with. It was a really quiet tow. Nobody really had much to say to each other. And I've never been so glad to see a dock in my life. We took our tired toddler home to bed, and my father and his wife settled down to sleep on their boat. The fuel dock was closed by that time, so they were just going to spend the night at the Coast Guard base. For many years, I thought this story was about me. I thought this was a story about my dislike of boating and my fear of boating, and a story about the last time I ever agreed to go on a boat, no matter who you are and how much I love you. But standing here looking back, I realize how awful that day must have been for my father. His whole life he was showered with accolades, journalists hanging on his every word. But he didn't care about all that. He was a truly humble man. He wasn't like Ted Turner, the flamboyant southerner that he raced America's Cup boats against. He just wanted to share his passion with his daughter and his only grandchild. Imagine how ashamed and disappointed with himself he was that day. Around midnight, sorry about the time, around midnight, we got a call. The Coast Guard had rescued my father for a third time. This time, they had taken him from the Coast Guard base to the emergency room. All that time in the, all those long minutes in the engine room with the fumes and the low oxygen, combined with the stress of disappointing us, had caused my father to have a stroke. A lot of bad things happened that day. But there's two things I'm really happy about. My father recovered completely in a matter of hours. No permanent damage. And I'm really happy to tell you that he has no memory of going out on the boat that day. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Bill Hansen. Bill Hansen and his love, Kate Troll, have lived in Ketchikan and Juneau since 1981. They have two children, Aaron and Ryan, who live in Juneau and other places. Bill retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on January 1st of this year and now lists his occupation as writing and recreation. He is considering following the footsteps of a friend with the business card, Professional Bad Influence. Recently, he sold his fourth novel, as well as the film rights to his unpublished previous three novels. Despite the large advance in film royalties, he and Kate plan to remain in their same home in Douglas and enjoy Southeast Alaska and friends, as always. Here's Bill.
Thank you. Well, if you know me well, or maybe even not so well, you may be saying, wait, that's not true. That introduction isn't true. But it isn't false either. It's actually my rearview mirror for the year 2017. And so my plan is that in that rearview mirror, everything in it is true except for the part that hasn't happened yet, which is I will finish my novel at the end of this month, my fourth novel, which hasn't been published yet, and neither have the three others. And it will be sold along with film rights and everything else by 2017. So that's my plan. When you retire, which I just did, you think about what you're going to do next. And I have a list of priorities that are basically in three categories. Have fun with Kate. Travel and go out and find adventure both here and far afield. And write. Mostly fiction, probably novels, just like I've been doing. And as I thought about that recently, I realized that actually took me back to another time when I really didn't have a job. 1993. Kate and I moved up in 92 and I left a job to move up with her. And I was looking around. It was a good time for me. I was writing. And we decided to take a trip to, as it turned out, Malaysia and Singapore. Not places I would have picked. I don't know if Kate, probably not either. But she's pretty good. She's really good. Kate taught me how to travel. That's what this is about. And she is very concise in helping figure out where to go. It's not pick the place so much as pick what you want to do and what you like and then do it. So what we did is we said, well, I want to go to a place that doesn't have English as a first language, but has English as a second language somewhere there, so you have some fallback. It's my first international trip ever. A place with warmth, beaches, places to visit that are interesting, like in this case, jungles, and an interesting people and culture. Singapore and Malaysia have a mixture of Chinese, Indian, and Native Malaysians, and they also have the religions of Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and the Chinese religions, all side by side, mixed up on streets, temples next to each other. It's a really interesting place. And the final thing was a place that was relatively safe for Americans, that would like Americans. So off we went. We sent the kids to Grandpa and Grandma. We got on the plane, went through Tokyo to Singapore. And on the way, Kate said to me, what are you planning to do next for work? You know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do for work? I said, well, I'd really like to be a writer. I'd like to write, but I don't think it's going to be something I can make a living on. So she said, well, be a writer. You can start right now. You're a writer. Be a writer. Every time somebody says, what do you do for work? Say, I'm a writer. And she had a job, but she said, you know, I think I'm going to do that too. It actually sounds like fun. So that's what we did. We became writers. So I mean, right as we went through passport control in Singapore, you know, occupation, I'm a writer. Kate also always has stretched my comfort zone and my boundaries, which is something I value highly. And in this trip, my first international trip, I think the thing that stretched me the most was she said, okay, we're gonna make reservations for the first couple of days when we get into Singapore and the last couple of days when we come back from Singapore. No more reservations, nothing. Nothing for hotels, nothing for transportation for the other two and a half weeks. We're going to travel up through Malaysia and back. We're just going to do it as we find it. And we went in the off season, so we had some idea that we'd have rooms available. So we did that. And it actually worked great, I have to say. I want to share one story that really has stuck with me through the years and meant a lot to me then and still represents our travel, as does this now. And that is, we got up first morning in Singapore, had breakfast, called a taxi to go downtown to visit a market that we found in our little guidebook, the Lonely Planet guidebook. And I was reading my journal last night, because I really did do a lot of writing on this trip. And in my journal it says, taxis don't take you where you want to go. Buses do. And this taxi, it wasn't the only one we took. But it did take us where we wanted to go. The problem was where we went and got to the right place, there was nothing there to go to. Because here in Singapore, and Singapore is a huge city. It's actually a really interesting place. It's a city-state. There aren't very many of these sovereign city-states, just a handful in the world. And that means it's a country and a city, but just a city and a country. And so it's 5.5 million people in a really tight little place. It's like a whole country in the middle of New York City. So we get to this place, which is a market that isn't open. It's not open, so we start walking into town, and it's empty. This entire city, there's not a person on the street. There's not a car. There's nothing. It's just Bill and Kate in all of Singapore, downtown Singapore. And we're like, what's going on? You know, we found out later it was a religious holiday that we didn't know about. Then the sky just opened up and it started raining, thunder, lightning, and we dodged for a Portacova Bank. We sat down the steps. We weren't really discouraged. We were just confused about what to do. And down the street through the rain, we saw a man walking toward us, a Malaysian man with his sarong that goes down to below the knees, umbrella over his head. He walks right up to us, and he smiles, beautiful smile, kind of broken teeth, but really beautiful smile. And he says, may I help you in English? And we told him our problem. He said, well, the Chinese district's always open. It's right over there. I'll show you where to go. He takes me out on the street, kind of says, Mrs., stay under the portico to Kate, which went over really well, and showed me kind of the where to go. We went back, and under the portico, he handed me his umbrella. And he said, here's my umbrella. Keep your wife dry. And I said, thank you. Let me pay you for the umbrella. And he said, no, you can't pay me for the umbrella. This is a special holiday. And I needed to give a gift to somebody. And so it's a gift from me. You're doing a giant favor. You're giving me a favor to take my umbrella. And then he just handed it to me and walked off down the rain, through the rain, and disappeared. So I just want to say that that's the way we travel, and that's what I hope to do. And thank you very much, Kate, for teaching me to travel.
You're listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event on KTOO News Juno. These stories were recorded on January 14, 2015 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Rear View Mirror. Curious? Visit www.mudrooms.org.
Our next speaker tonight is Ryan Johnson. And here's what he wrote. Oh, how I love to write in the third person. Not really, so I won't. I grew up in Southeast Alaska. So now this is like not me, this is Ryan, right? I grew up in Southeast Alaska, mostly in Juneau, but I like to hold on to those few years we lived in Myers Chuck, out in the woods on the Cleveland Peninsula. That's not supposed to be funny. I've dabbled in adulthood. That probably is, though. I've dabbled in adulthood over the years, but have come to the conclusion that it's overrated and unnecessary. I have an insatiable wanderlust, but Juno is my home. Ryan Johnson, everyone.
I had a little bit of time to think about this every month. Ryan, are you doing Mudrooms this month? No, I'm not. About 4 months coming into it, and I'm still not really sure what I'm going to say. I want to talk to you guys a little bit tonight about the term dirtbag. The term that was used to describe me a lot in my 20s. Not the kind of dirtbag that you wouldn't want to leave your sister or any woman you care about with, but probably wouldn't have been the best idea, but a climbing dirtbag. It's different from a ski bum. Might be a little bit worse. Skiing and ice climbing are different because you can't actually sleep in the dirt, and when you're rock climbing, you can sleep in the dirt. It's generally pretty warm. I spent a lot of my 20s in our national parks, living in campgrounds, or not, sometimes out in the woods, hiding from rangers. When you overstay, you're welcome. But I did find myself spending a lot of time in Montana. It's where I went to college. I didn't finish because the outside is more fun. And my last stint, I was in Bozeman. And Bozeman is probably where I should have spent most of my time. There's lots of climbing dirt bags, but they, in the West, they get divvied up pretty easily. There's the guys from California, and these days it's actually more girls from California, strong climbers. Colorado, Colorado bros, there's tons of them. They travel in packs. Tacomas, and whatever their parents bought them, whatever vehicle shows up, they love to go to your secret area and crash it in massive parties. Alaska and Montana and Wyoming, we're sparsely populated, so we tend to kind of group together, and we have guns. So, yeah. It's, yeah, we're a different breed, but it's a lot of fun. And when I was in Bozeman, I met some guys in Yosemite, and they're like, yeah, come to Bozeman, we'll climb a bunch. And so I decided that I'd transfer to go to school there, and I lasted 3 weeks in school. But I showed up on December 23rd. I was going to stick around Seattle, but I was just too eager to go climb with my friends. And I drove my 88 Subaru straight to Bozeman and found out that everyone was, in fact, home for the holidays. There was no one in Bozeman. So I spent Christmas living in the Hofbrau Bar parking lot. They had a wood stove, and I spent my days climbing, off in Hyalite by myself, listening to Bob Dylan and sleeping in my car. Mom and Dad are probably thrilled to know that. I think I actually talked to them. But eventually everyone came home, and I got to move out of my car after a couple weeks. They kind of got eased into it, and I was in a house with about 12 other people. The only person whose name was actually on the lease was a guy named Tyler Nygaard. He was a professor of biology and is now on some research grant at the University of Michigan, but he was good on paper, strong climber, strong skier, and various other people. I stayed there for a while until I needed to find a more permanent residence, and I moved in with another climber who was a student, but he was married, totally legit on paper. And I got to live in his office because his wife was tired of him bringing home his dirtbag friends to sleep on their couch, because we generally also smell pretty bad because we don't have very many changes of clothes. So he built about a double bed-sized bunk in his office. And I lived there for 2 months. I was expected to pay rent, but he was remodeling his house, and he had a 114-year-old house. So I actually made money on the deal. It was pretty sweet. I worked for Meridian Roofing, roofing in Bozeman in the winters, not very much fun. I fell off my first roof. But that's the thing that also separates a lot of the northwestern dirtbags from down south is dirtbags in the northwest generally have jobs. They generally work a little bit more. They don't have as much family money, generally have a little bit family support, but they generally have jobs and they pay their way. So it's a lot of fun to live that lifestyle. Things that, that word dirtbag really sounds bad to a lot of people because, dirtbag sounds like scumbag. And they're different. There's dirtbags that have been found diving in dumpsters all throughout California or anywhere near Joshua Tree and in Utah and wherever else. There's a climbing area nearby. But anybody who's going to, get upset about that needs to go and walk through any produce aisle in Juneau and then go dive in a dumpster in Southern California. It's great. You'll feel really good about what you find. Anyway, so when I left Bozeman, it was sad. There were the Palliser brothers, Kyler and Eric, who they graduated the same year, even from college, even though they were 3 years apart, and their rich uncle bought them a brand new Toyota Tundra. In 6 years, they put 230,000 miles on it and killed it. Truck's dead. Brand new pickup truck. But they traveled a lot and climbed a lot, and I'd see them down in the deserts in Utah, and these are the guys that I originally met in California before I moved to Bozeman. We were going to come back up here together with our other friend Sam Magro, but Eric hurt his finger and they decided to go to Australia instead. It happens. Well, when I left Bozeman, we hopped in my 88 Subaru, and Sam and I drove all the way back to Washington to Bellingham and met some other friends from Alaska there and went out for a lifelong ski tour from Mount Baker up Mount Ann and came back out just in time to sell my car, which I didn't have a title for, and I didn't get a bill of sale on the side of the road, so we'd have enough money to get on the ferry to get back to Juneau and eventually climb here. Now, the thing that is funny about that is as I'm becoming an adult, you know, I didn't want this to sound like an obituary to my 20s, but it feels that way a little bit. I'm moving towards adulthood or, you know, being slingshot at it. But it's something I look back, and, you know, when you look back, you always remember the best of times, and you remember who your friends were, and you kind of wish you knew who they are now. But when I look back, I see my friends as they were then, you know, offering me a free couch or empty space in a car or a spot on some expedition to some far-off land, because in that time, our dreams were our reality, and anything was possible, and it was wonderful. So when I see my friends, I like where I am now, and I hope they do too.
Our next speaker is Kristen Stouder. Although driving was always her biggest fear, not knowing what to do after finishing college in Washington, Kristen took a job driving tour buses in Juneau, which proved both terrifying and hilarious. After finishing her master's degree in psychology, she took a job teaching people to drive buses, which also proved terrifying and hilarious. Kristen has spent much of her life looking in rearview mirrors, both professionally and personally. Having lived recent months in Anchorage, she is grateful for the chance to return to Juneau and be surrounded by those friends who helped her overcome her biggest fear and keep her looking forward instead of fixating on the rearview mirror of her life. She now works as a research analyst with the state of Alaska, but will always remember fondly those days of diesel exhaust and breakdowns. Here's Kristen.
So driving has always been my biggest fear, more than public speaking, more than death, driving. I didn't take the freeway until I was 19. So naturally, when I graduated college, I took a job driving tour buses in Juneau, Alaska. I had a number of friends who had done the job before, and my friend Hillary said something that finally convinced me. She was like, "Look, Kristen, you're going to meet the dumbest people in Alaska, and if they can do it, you can do it." So I signed up, and thankfully they start you off in the parking lot, right? You're just doing really basic things like starting and stopping the bus and making some turns. But a lot of training is really, that training was learning to use your mirrors, especially in turns, to see where you're going. And I'll be honest that through most of my training, like, I was never really sure what I was supposed to see in those mirrors. I would usually just guess, and then I would pray a lot, and angels of the Lord would come down and move things out of the way for me, like people and mailboxes and that kind of thing. So it was great. One time, though, partway through my training, my trainer asked me to do this kind of difficult right-hand turn. And so I was kind of nervous about it. The light turned green at the intersection, and I pulled the bus forward, and I made my guess, and I could tell pretty quickly that I'd guessed really badly, because I could see in my right-hand mirror that the back of my bus, the tires, were about to go up and over this curb. And that's like an automatic fail on your drive test, right? So I was like, ugh. So I'm like so focused in this mirror. I'm totally fixated on it. I'm like praying to God above, and there's no angels coming down this time. I'm all on my own. I'm just like trying to inch this bus around the curb, and there's no hope. And all of a sudden, my trainer yells, "Stop." And so I stop, and for the first time in this whole maneuver, I look in front of me. And right in front of my bus, there's like a foot in front of me, there's a car that I completely missed. And I'm staring down at this woman who's driving the car, and she's looking up at me. And her mouth is open in that silent scream. And, I mean, the look on her face, it can only be described as, like, that's the look you get when you're about to get hit by a bus. So I learned a really important lesson that day in training. I realized I'd been so focused on what was going on behind me, which had already happened, that I was totally missing out on what was going on right in front of me, and that stuck with me. So somehow I passed my commercial driving test in April of 2010, and I was on, before I knew it, was on a plane to come up here to Juneau to give tours. And that year in 2010 was pretty special. The company I worked for still had these old GMC buses. Like, if you've ever seen Speed with Sandra Bullock, yeah, it's like totally that kind of bus. Like, no power steering, there's no heat or air conditioning, there's no luggage space. So, like, people come on board and they've got wheelchairs and walkers and stuff, and there's nowhere to put it except to bungee cord it to the front rail. And that effectively blocks the main exit, so I'm not really sure that that's legal, but that's what we did. And no air conditioning, like not super a problem in Juneau for temperature, but we get a lot of rain here, right? So the windshield would fog up without something to take the moisture out. So I had a friend, thankfully, who gave me a tip. She was like, hey, if you put dish soap on that windshield and then turn on your defrost, it'll act as a moisture barrier. It will prevent it from fogging. So I did that. I put a nice layer of dish soap on it, and then I'm cruising back into town on Egan, and I turned on the defrost, and it blew bubbles to the back of the bus because I put so much soap on it. Yeah, people had a great time, too. We got back to Marine Park, and this guy gets off my bus, and he gives me $200. And he told me to go buy some power steering for my bus. And I was like, I love this job. So that effectively cured my fear of driving right there. So I came back for four more summers as I worked my way through grad school. And the summer of 2013, I came up. I was pretty excited that summer. I spent a lot of time in Juneau up until then. And I was pretty excited to come up for the summer season and to stay year-round, actually. I had just finished my master's degree, and I was looking forward to living a life year-round in Alaska. So I came up that summer and had a lot of hope in that. But by the end of that summer, I knew I couldn't stay, because by the end of that summer, I carried a secret. Because that summer I got raped, and I didn't tell anybody. All I knew was I couldn't stay in Juneau, because I just knew I had to go home. When I looked in the rearview mirror of my life at Juneau, all I saw was pain and sadness. So I did. I went home to Washington, and I just kind of spun my wheels there for a while. But I'd always loved Alaska, and I'd always wanted to stay here. So I decided to, like, thankfully it's a big state, and I decided I'd go up to Anchorage this time and start a new life. So I did. Last April, I drove all the way up to Anchorage. And in a lot of ways, it was really amazing. It was amazing to be in a new part of Alaska and see all the scenery and to be on the road system. But I always missed the community that I had here in Juneau. I couldn't find that up there. And I felt lonely a lot. One night, I can remember, I had gotten off work kind of late, and I was driving home to my house in Anchorage. And I got on the freeway, and I heard a sound on top of my car. And immediately my eyes went to the rearview mirror of my car, where I saw my phone, which I had left on top of my car, fly behind me and shatter into 1,000 pieces on the freeway. And I just pulled over to the side of the freeway, and I just cried. I cried like I should have cried a year ago. I cried because I felt so alone, and now I couldn't even call anybody. And as I was sitting there crying on the side of the freeway, for some reason, that image came to my mind of when I was driving this bus and looking at the mirror and missing out on life in front of me. And I realized that I had been living my life that way for the last year. I had been so focused on what was going on behind me that I was completely missing out on living my life going forward. So long story short, I got a new phone, and I was applying for year-round jobs, and for some reason, I got a job in Juneau. I was having a hard time getting offers in Anchorage, but I got a job in Juneau that sounded pretty attractive. So I moved back, and I had a lot of apprehension about coming back. But I tell you what, I got off the ferry that night in late August, and coming into town, it felt like greeting an old friend. And I guess I wanted to say tonight, thank you to my friends and to Juneau, my community, for welcoming me back, even though you didn't know my story. And I guess I also wanted to say tonight that, you know, I don't know what's in the rearview mirror of your life, but I do know that life is short, and it's too precious to live it just staring at the past. And I have decided for myself that I'm going to live my life now moving forward. And since I've done that, the events in the rearview mirror of my life have been getting further every day.
Gypsy, Soul Searcher, Forrest Gump, Castaway, even ZZ Top or Axl Rose. Kanan Bosler has been called many different names over the past 2.5 years.
traveling by kayak, bicycle, sailboat, train, thumb, bus, foot, and plane from Juneau to Patagonia and back may have made him a bit rough around the edges, but he likes to think he's better off for it. His prolonged displacement from Southeast Alaska was both exciting and exhausting, and he now understands what Dorothy meant when she told Toto, "There's no place like home."
So, what's like the sketchiest thing that happened to you guys down there? This is almost always the first question I get when I start telling people about my recent trip down to South America, and I find it really interesting that I get this question so often because I have literally hundreds of great experiences I'd rather talk about, but for some reason I'm constantly forced to rack my mind and think of the one or two bad things that might have happened, so I don't really like this question, but I figured that Mudrooms here could be a good opportunity to get past it and just get over this question, so I'll make you all a deal, alright? I'll tell you about the sketchiest thing that happened to me on this trip, but you gotta promise me you'll never ask me that damn question again. Seriously, promise? Yeah? Okay. Alright. Alright, well this story takes place in Baja, California, which is that northwesternmost state in Mexico. And for those of you that have been to Baja, you can probably imagine that it's actually a pretty gnarly place to ride a bicycle. I mean, relative to the rest of our trip at least. Aside from being a desert in between two seas that have some pretty harsh weather conditions to navigate, it's also just largely unpopulated. And so the distances between towns can get really long, and you have to really plan ahead with food and water and make sure, because you can be riding for up to a couple days at a time without getting reprovisioned. So it was basically like the closest we got to like wilderness cycling on the trip. But with these long distances between towns, these roads, they get really long. And the thing about that is the cargo trucks that are delivering goods up and down the peninsula, they go fast. Like, there's no one else around. So, I mean, I had this rear view mirror on my bicycle helmet. And so most of the time I could see them coming. But if I was coming around a corner or something, you know, by the time I knew they were there, they were already honking by. So it was a little bit sketchy. But anyways, this one day I was riding along, and I was actually at the back of the group, well behind everyone. I had told them to go ahead. And so I was probably a good, like, 20 or 30 minutes behind everyone else. And so I was kind of cruising along, riding, trying to catch up, pumping along, just jamming to my iPod, you know. And this northbound truck coming the opposite direction starts slowing down in front of me with his hand out the window doing this kind of stop, slow down motion. So we both stop in the middle of the road, and I say, "Hola, hay un problema?" So this is about 2 weeks into Mexico, so I barely knew any Spanish at this point, and so I can't claim to remember exactly what he said, but I think it was probably something like, "Hey, puto, ¿quieres chupar el gallo?" Like I said, I had no idea what he just said. So I said, "¿Cómo?" And this time, instead of wasting his breath with useless words, he just decided to use sign language. So he said, and he actually pulled out his taquito. No, gracias. And the last thing, this image that's burned in my memory from my rear view mirror on my bike helmet is of this old dirty pervert who I probably just thoroughly offended. His eyes locked on me, and he's frantically digging behind his seat, and I'm just thinking he's pulling out the sawed-off shotgun. So I was out of there fast, and when I came into the next town, my buddies said they thought I was a motorcycle. I was pedaling so fast. And I came in, and I told them what happened, and they could tell I was pretty shook up, and, you know, they were a bit freaked out, too. So
we decided to ride together at least for the rest of the day. But then a couple days later, we met these Argentinian guys, and they were doing the same bike trip as us. It's a couple of cyclists from Alaska down to Argentina, and they're some pretty cool dudes, so we decided to travel with them for a bit, but they didn't really like to camp, was their thing. Our program had always been, you know, like stock up on food in the late afternoon and then ride out of town and go camp somewhere out in the desert. But these guys, they'd rather stay in town, so what they would do is they'd actually ask the Catholic Church in town for free accommodation. And so we got on their program this first night. We stayed with them, and I mean, like, they spoke Spanish, so that helped. So they kind of set us up and made us, like, forever remember that they helped us so much. And but anyway, so we were in this church, and, you know, I was still feeling a little bit self-conscious about this whole truck driver incident, but, you know, I was in the church, so might as well do my confession, right? And so I told these guys this story, and they reacted quite a bit differently to my traumatic experience than my friends originally had. Nico and Tatan, they just lost it, started laughing at me and making fun of me, and I had just met these guys, they're already laughing at my expense, you know? But in the end, it was therapeutic, and I feel like that's kind of the power of oral storytelling, you know? You can turn this scary, sketchy, embarrassing story into something that's laughable and in the end can help you. So I just want to thank Mudrooms for providing the opportunity to tell these stories and get me up here on the therapist couch in front of all of you. And yeah, I guess in the end, I understand where people are coming from when they ask me about these sketchy experiences, because they can be entertaining and they can help me in the end, but just remember, we got a deal now. All right.
This is KTOO News Juneau 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on January 14th, 2015. The theme for the evening was Rear View Mirror. To tell your story or to find out when you can attend the next live event, visit mudrooms.org. Audio production by Steve Suing and Alita Buff, with additional help from Tom Cosgrove, Rich Moniak, Katie Spielberger, and Pat Roach. I'm Amanda Compton. Have a good night.